This is Joe Clement for the Old Mole Variety Hour, joined today by Marianne Labatt. Marianne is an organizer with the Industrial Workers of the World, a labor union, and specifically with the union of the Stardust Diner in New York, Stardust Family United. She's here today to tell us a little bit about solidarity unionism. Thanks for coming on the Old Mole.
Thanks for inviting me.
So you're at a training right now on this, and you're taking a break to kind of continue that training by ear with us. Could you just tell us first what solidarity unionism is, and then we can kind of consider the wider ramifications, where it comes from, where it could go?
So solidarity unionism is based on the idea that the best way for workers to exert their power and get their demands and their needs met in the workplace and beyond is to take direct action at work. So most of the model of unionism that we're familiar with involves elections and then bargaining a contract with the employer, and that bargaining is done by paid officers of the union. In this organizing model, it's the workers themselves forming a committee and talking amongst themselves about what their issues are and what they want to do about them, voting on taking action, and then taking action in the workplace in relation to the employer. And so, you know, some of the tactics, some of the direct action tactics can include refusing unsafe work or work slowdowns or even strikes, marching on the boss with a particular demand and just articulating their demands and their grievances directly and that kind of thing. But the important part is that it's really worker-led and democratically decided, and that it takes place right there in the workplace, as opposed to, say, in an office somewhere behind closed doors with, like, paid union bureaucrat negotiators and then lawyers from the company.
Well, I guess that gets at how this contrasts with conventional or more mainstream union organizing. I've seen it referred to as minority unionism, and I'm wondering if you could speak to just how this organizing model deals with the situation where, you know, there's lots of people out there who are interested in unions, want better representation at work, but, you know, they look to their workplace and, you know, they're one or two or five out of a lot more people who they know are sympathetic to this. And what does solidarity unionism, minority unionism, kind of offer workers in those positions?
The union experience that most people have and that most people are familiar with involves a union that negotiates a contract on their behalf. And then if there's a violation of that contract by either the employer or the union, the other side can grieve, can complain about it. And then, you know, they kind of, again, hash it out with the experts, with the lawyers, and come to some kind of settlement or agreement. And in that process, workers have found that unions will kind of let them down because they'll say, have an issue at work, and they'll bring it to their union representative or shop steward or whatever and try to grieve that, try to rectify that situation. And often the union won't even take it on. And it's not because unions are like evil, you know, cartoons or something, but because taking on a grievance is a really intense commitment that involves, you know, hiring the right lawyers and putting the right bureaucrats on the job, and it can cost the union up to like $40,000 or $50,000 even to grieve something, and that's not even a guarantee that you win. And so unions have become these sort of large bureaucracies that are somewhat disconnected with the workplace and with workers in those workplaces. And solidarity unionism is about relocating the fight right to the shop floor, as we call it, so to the workplace. And as a result, it can sometimes take the form of a minority in the workplace taking action. If there are five or six people who want to take on a particular issue and put pressure on the boss to fix that issue, let's say it has to do with the air conditioner being broken or, you know, somebody not getting accommodation for their disability, whatever it may happen to be. Sometimes five or six people can absolutely be enough to pressure the boss successfully. But the solidarity unionism model itself does not necessarily mean a minority. In the case of the Stardust Diner in New York, for example, they have a majority of the workers and have from the beginning, but they didn't have an election and they didn't bargain out a contract. They just take action as necessary.
As a public sector worker, I think this is really important. The Supreme Court case Janus versus AFSCME Local 31 might dramatically affect the way that unions are funded, public sector unions, that is. They wouldn't collect dues from people who weren't card-carrying union members, but who still worked in those workplaces and benefited from the contracts and were legally entitled to representation from the union should they, say, want to grieve a contract violation. You mentioned that contract violations and grievances are costly matters, and I think this is changing the political strategy of public sector worker unions. You know, I've seen this in my own union where they're starting to talk about kind of take direct action at work before you file a grievance. And you even hear staffers referring to contracts as like, this is the way that management wants us to struggle because it, you know, it fits into their bureaucratic world where they have power and where they can, you know, just drag things out, which is what we don't have a lot of time and extended capacity. And it sounds like solidarity unionism is the bleeding edge of this idea that, you know, we start taking care of ourselves and we can, you know, start doing things first locally, but we start to realize that we can all do bigger things together.
That's fascinating. And I was actually just talking to a friend who works for a union of public employees in Canada, and he was describing the same thing, how his union, which is a mainstream union, you know, they still operate in the old ways where they bargain these contracts that are often like full of concessions. And then sort of quietly on the side, they're encouraging workers to take the act of matters into their own hands and like engage in wildcat or illegal strikes and that kind of thing. So it's funny because I think that that shows two things. Even unions themselves recognize how much their hands have been tied by contracts and by the law. And some examples of that are contracts will often include a no-strike clause. So during the life of the contract, you're not allowed to go out on strike, and you're not even, in fact, allowed to take any kind of disruptive action at work. And if you do, the employer can grieve that. So, it, like I said earlier, it's not just the employees who can grieve a violation of the contract. The employer can grieve a violation of the contract, too. The whole National Labor Relations Board system that we have was implemented, and this is in the legislation, to ensure the free flow of commerce. So it was implemented in order to ensure labor peace. At a time when there was massive unrest happening in labor, working conditions were terrible, workers would rise up, they'd engage in these huge militant actions, strike waves, and so on and so forth. And so the government intervened and created a system whereby employers had to sit down and bargain with workers. But the trade-off was that then people had to kind of go back to work and behave in a way that was more peaceful. And we're really seeing the limit of that model. The last 10 years have involved news that is all bad. I joke about this with the Stardust workers. Like when that headline hit recently about the Supreme Court and the way that they're going to, that employers can individually negotiate with workers about things like wage theft and violations. Like I said to them, all the news is going to be bad news. For the last 10 years and for the foreseeable future, all the headlines, the Supreme Court decisions, the legislation is probably all going to be bad news. But the alternative, the still very, very promising alternative to that is solidarity, unionism, and direct action. So the fact that mainstream unions are endorsing it, I think, is an indication of two things. First, that they recognize how much their hands have been tied by the official, you know, bargaining process. And second, that they know how much power there actually is in that kind of activity. But at the same time, you know, it still remains the case that unions will be threatened and jeopardized by workers taking things into their own hands. And they can get fined for that, and they can get, you know, face challenges and grievances for that, and they can, you know, face legal repercussions for that too. So I think that the amount of support you're going to get for that from mainstream unions when push comes to shove is going to have limitations.
Yeah, even in AFSCME's own history, the one of the most famous kind of strike actions, the sanitation workers in 1968, it was an independent worker action that was often, you know, kind of in AFSCME's own history, one of the most famous strike actions was the Memphis sanitation worker strike in 1968. And that's an example of a independent worker action where workers were going off on strike, first of all, without necessarily the support of the union. And then as time went on, the union just wanted to try and get the workers back to work so that they could get the employer in a more amenable position to sit down at the table, as it were. And because they held out and because they held to their demands, they, you know, eventually won the strike.
And that's what happened in Quebec, too, where there was a massive student strike that happened in 2012 to resist ultimately a 70% increase in tuition. And that student strike was organized outside of an already existing union system or structure. So unlike in the United States and Canada, students are allowed to join unions that are like basically labor unions. If they had those, pretty much every student belonged to one or another, and they sidestepped that infrastructure. And what they did was they created these committees in like every individual department, and then every individual, what they call a faculty, and then every individual university. And eventually they got like hundreds of thousands of students out on strike acting together that way. My understanding is that the teacher strike in West Virginia and some of the other ones have, some of those teachers are represented formally by unions and some are not. And what they've done is they've created that same kind of ground up committee model, where they started with like a hallway in a school, and then the school district, where they put control back in workers' hands, voted on actions, and then took them. And we've seen the power of that in the amount of concessions that have been given to these workers using tactics. And it's funny because, you know, like even from the capitalist perspective or from the government perspective or something, like you have to make sure that the system works for people. If it doesn't work for people, if your processes that you're trying to funnel them into no longer get them what they need, they will start eventually acting outside of that. And that's exactly what we're seeing. So there's a short-sightedness on the part of like capitalism itself with respect to constantly going after workers' rights and unions, where eventually you see the spillover in terms of folks literally taking the streets in order to get what they want.
In the last few minutes, could you talk a bit about the industrial workers of the world itself and where it fits into the current labor movement and what role it's having in the dissemination of this organizing strategy?
Back in the day, the union was founded in 1905, and it became incredibly powerful and sort of set the tone in a lot of ways for labor unions and for worker activity in the United States. And one of the reasons it was powerful was because it took everybody. So whereas unions at the time, many of them were organized by craft or by trade, they took the skilled workers. If you were a carpenter or if you were a plumber or something like that, you know, that's who was organized into these craft unions or trade unions. Whereas the IWW was about organizing everybody. And that also crossed racial and gender lines because they understood that a working class divided is going to be less powerful. And it would have these huge, massive strikes and movements in you know, timber and in all these mining and different industries. And it was one of the ones that was most brutally repressed because of its success and also because of its organizing model. And, you know, for a couple of decades, there wasn't a tremendous amount of organizing going on the part of the IWW. But in the last, let's say, since the late 90s or early 2000s, the IWW kind of got in touch with its revolutionary roots again because it took on areas of work that no other union seemed to be that interested in. So that included things like, well, Starbucks or Jimmy John's. So fast food and retail. We see a lot of union interest in that now, but for a long time, you know, union ideas of worker power and where to organize was factories, you know, auto manufacturing.
Middle-class jobs.
Middle-class jobs, well, they became middle-class jobs through union organizing, but the kind of jobs were like a sort of sole breadwinner, earning a single paycheck, working 40 hours a week is working. But the reality is that that doesn't describe work for a lot of working people anymore. They gather together two or three jobs. They're part-time and insecure at every one of them. It's a retail environment, not a manufacturing environment. And so I think that the IWW, we were very, very small, but we kind of pushed the envelope a little bit in terms of what is considered the right location to organize and where to organize. And then also in terms of the model, again, we've always been, or for the last couple of decades, we've been really, really small numerically. And we're just kind of like a tiny little scrappy remnant of what we used to be. But at the same time, you can see the kind of imagination there that goes in direction of taking direct action, forming solidarity unions in a way that can't be affected by all this bad news that comes down about workers not having to pay dues while we collect dues on a voluntary basis anyway, or undermining contracts while we don't necessarily sign contracts. We focus on direct action instead. So it's a great model. And to answer your question, the way that we proliferated is by doing the kind of thing that I'm doing right now, which is we have these organizer trainings where we take workers, so not union staffers, but workers, and we give them the skills they need in order to start a campaign, a solidarity union at their own workplace, you know, starting from scratch and just build this up themselves with their coworkers, ultimately to the point of taking action.
Well, that's all the time we have for the on-air portion of this conversation I've been having with Mary Ann Labatt of the IWW Industrial Workers of the World. If you want to hear us talking a little bit more about solidarity unionism and what it looks like in the world today, you can go to the Old Mole website when this is posted and find that extended material. Thank you, Mary Ann, for coming on the Old Mole to talk to us today.
Thanks.
Yeah, I'd be remiss if I didn't mention that the Industrial Workers of the World, you know, they have led in the successful unionization, or at least a certain level of recognition that has never been given to fast food workers in the Burgerville Workers Union that is now, you know, unionized, quote unquote, two buildings and set to unionize many more in the next year.
Yeah, and my understanding too is that those are some of the first successful elections in fast food. These were successful elections in fast food organizing. But again, like, not all of the IWW approaches like that without using anything in the way of contracts or elections. The Stardust Union has racked up this list of victories. Like, they have a pumping, nursing, lactation room for new moms, which the employer refused to provide for years and years and years, despite even being sued over this issue. There was a practice of wage theft with large group parties where the restaurant would skim like a good 7-8% of the tips that was supposed to go to the servers. They put an end to that through direct action. They had unsafe equipment in the restaurant. They refused to use it, and the owner had to replace it to the tune of tens of thousands of dollars. They've increased staffing levels to adequate levels. They've refused unpaid rehearsal, so in other words, working for free. They've refused being filmed without their consent. They recently won a raise for the hosts to $15 an hour from $11 to $13 an hour, depending on the host. Again, all of this without the use of any kind of official negotiation or contracts or, you know, getting the government to intervene or whatever. All of that stuff was won just through direct action on the shop floor.
I mean, you're making demands, but you're doing it with, you know, the body of the workers there actually issuing it.
Right. And the important thing is that 2 years ago, 2.5 years ago, when a new management team came in and started bullying workers and firing them left and right, the workers were afraid of management, and rightfully so. They were being bullied. 2.5 years later, after they have this solidarity union in place, management is terrified of them. Like, I listened to a recording. They presented some demand to management the other day, and somebody recorded management's response and sent it to me, and I listened to it, and you can actually hear, like, the trembling in the general manager's voice and him sort of, like, stammering as he's giving this response to these workers. Like, they're afraid of workers now, and that's, as a result, you know, pretty much anything they ask for, they get. That's how it should be. Bosses should be afraid of workers because bosses need workers. Workers don't need the boss.
Well, on that note, I think we need to end this wonderful conversation. I've been talking with Mary Ann Labatt, IWW Industrial Workers of the World organizer with Stardust Family United, talking about solidarity unionism. Is there anything else you think that listeners, workers, would-be organizers in the workplaces should know about what the IWW is doing?
Just definitely get out there and do it. You know, if you are wherever you work, a lot of times we think that, oh, organizing doesn't apply to me because I'm a student or I work at a nonprofit or whatever. We all work in different ways in different places. If you want to organize your workplace, get out there and do it. And get in touch with the IWW if you want a training.